Alrighty, so just a quick reminder of the verse that we want to commit to memory, Genesis 3:15. Of course, this is a great verse because it provides us evidence that from the beginning, it was not as if God had no idea what was going to happen. It was not as if God was scrambling to come up with a plan. Well, what am I going to do now? But no, from the very beginning, the moment that man sins, God begins to give us hope. Of course, this is part of the curse to the serpent, and I will put enmity or hostility between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Of course, giving us the first glimpse of how that here we have the serpent who came in and undermined man's relationship with God, but God is going to provide a Savior who is going to take away, rob the devil of his power, rob that serpent of old of his power. All right, Genesis 1 through 5. I don't think we're going to do a whole lot of memory work in here, but if you don't know, the chapters of Genesis are largely pretty easy to keep track of, and so I thought I might take a minute and let's just go back and if you had to sum up in just a few words what are in chapters 1 through 5 of Genesis, they're pretty easy to keep track of. So let me get somebody to tell me first. What's in Genesis chapter 1? Genesis chapter 1. Creation. Yeah, if you just had to sum up in a word, creation. Of course, we get days 1 through 6 of creation. What about chapter 2? Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, in fact. And so we really finish up creation there with day 7, but then we zoom in on Adam and Eve there in the garden. What about chapter 3? Hint, we just talked about it. Yeah, the first sin or the fall. So that's in chapter 3. And then Cain and Abel. Gave it away. Chapter 4, Cain and Abel. Things don't go much better as we move into chapter 4. And then finally, what do we have in chapter 5? Yeah, genealogies or the generations of Adam in particular. And of course, what's nice about this is we'll get a few more chapters of content, and then we have another list of generations in chapter 10. So if you can remember, on your fives, at least for the first 10 chapters, on your fives, you've got generations. Okay. I was talking with Chris. He had some oral surgery, by the way, and asked me to fill in for him. And I was talking with him about how he wanted to proceed here. And he said there was a word he wanted to say about Enoch at the last class. So I thought we'd take just a moment to take a look at Enoch. So if you'll take a look at chapter 5 here, in particular, verse 23. So let's look at what verse 23 has to tell us about Enoch. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Now that's not a whole lot, right? That he walked with God. Okay, well, we get some idea of his character, but then he was not, for God took him. That doesn't tell us a whole lot about exactly what happened there. Do we have anything in the New Testament that gives us a little more information about what happened to Enoch and also about Enoch's character? Hebrews, all right, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 11 through 5. Pardon me, verses 11 through 5. I'm sorry, verses Hebrews 11, verse 5. Pardon me. Let's turn over there right quick and let's read what Hebrews tells us about Enoch. And if I could get a volunteer for that. Hebrews 11, verse 5. Okay, so a lot of things in there, I'd say. So number one, Enoch acted by faith. We could probably have determined that from this idea of walking with God that Genesis gives us. But by faith he acted. But then he goes on to explain a little bit. Again, we can infer this, I suppose, because there's not much else that it could mean. But it's nice to have it spelled out. He was taken away so that he did not see death. So Enoch is the one man in all of history who was just... One of two men in all of history who did not have to see death, whom God just took into heaven, and has not had to go through the pain and the struggle of death. Even our Lord was not spared that, but Enoch was granted this gift. So he did not see death, and then finally, he pleased God. Again, he walked with God. That I think that's pretty clear. But in case there's any question about what that means. He was pleasing to God. The writer of Hebrews makes that plain here. He had a testimony that he pleased God. What about another place? Do we have, say, some of the words of Enoch recorded anywhere in the New Testament? Jude 14 and 15. That's right. So let's go take a look over there right quick. Sam, you want to go ahead and read that for us? Jude 14 and 15? Okay, so then, what's the first thing that we learned about Enoch? What could he do that not many men in history could do? Yeah, he could prophesy. So he was a prophet. Now, we have these words that he goes on to, well, I guess I should say that Jude goes on to record for us, which Enoch apparently spoke. When did he speak those words? I don't know. Sometime in his life. We're not given any more of a glimpse into Enoch than what we have back there in Hebrew, in Genesis, and then now these words here in Hebrews. But as you can imagine, as we'll get into here in just a little bit, as the world was growing worse and worse and worse, here we get a glimpse that Enoch apparently was one of God's prophets who was trying to say, hey, let's pull back from the edge of the abyss here, because there are not good things in store for those who do not, who speak ill of God and who do not love and worship Him. So it's interesting that we get just this brief mention of Enoch back in Genesis, and we have to go to the New Testament to get a fuller picture of who he was. All right, any comments on Enoch before we move into our lesson proper this time, or at this time? Okay, chapter 6 then. Moving into Genesis chapter 6. Okay, so I'm just going to use the questions basically as an outline. So let me ask you first, who are the sons of God mentioned there in Genesis 6 verses 2 and 4? Yeah, I think that's right. And in fact, I think this is an opportunity to comment on a rule of biblical interpretation. Without any information that tells us otherwise, there's no reason to go off on some wild speculation. And so as Alan says back in the last verse of chapter 4, verse 26 there, very last sentence there, then men began to call on the name of the Lord. And this is just an idea that they are coming before God in order to worship Him. And they're calling on Him for His blessings and for His mercy. So then, as we move into chapter 6, and it says that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, well, we're just talking, I think, about those who were faithful to God. In fact, let's back up just a bit. It came to pass, this is verse 1 here, came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. So, what was the picture? As we left off with Cain, what was the picture of Cain and his descendants versus Shem and Adam and Eve's other children and their descendants? What was the picture there? Were they all together in one place? No. What was the curse that was placed on Cain? Yeah, he was banished, right? He was off on his own. And so here Cain, and as you can imagine, he's not going to raise up a people who are going to respect God, whereas the implication is that Shem and his descendants do respect God. And so I think that's the euphemism, if you will, for these two parties. You have the descendants of Cain, who are the sons of men, and of course, their daughters. And then you have the sons of God, which is to say the descendants of Shem, by and large, those who were faithful to God and who respected Him. Now, I'm sure most of you know that there's a theory that, well, we have sons of God coming down, that we're talking about angels here, and that's where the giants came from because they mated with human women. No, that's not what's going on there. We can look at other places in the Bible. If we look at Romans chapter 8, we're called sons of God through faith. If we look at Galatians chapter 3, we're called sons of God because we follow in the steps of Abraham. And then, of course, in the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Exactly. So the phrase sons of God is not unknown to be talking about those who are faithful to God. All right. There's no reason to go off on some fanciful theory there. We could even take a look at when Jesus is answering the Sadducees about resurrection. And what does he basically say? He says, now, the angels don't mate. Okay. There is no marriage in heaven. And so that pretty well dashes that theory altogether. So then, if that is the case, who were these giants? And where did they come from? Verse 4, there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward. So if we're not talking about some sort of a super breed of humans, whom are we talking about? Right. This word, Nephal, that it comes from, depending on your translation, it may render giants, as mine does here. It may say Nephilim. But the idea is that it is someone who falls upon another as if to oppress him. So we're really talking about tyrants here, people who exercise their authority over other men in apparently an evil fashion. So this is not giants in the sense that we have Goliath saw walking around in those days. These are giants the same way. Well, sometimes we talk about standing on the shoulders of giants, or sometimes we talk about giants of industry. Nobody has any is under the impression that we're talking about some 10-foot or 8-foot men walking around who are heroes in their industry. No, we're just saying that they are men who have been able to accomplish a great deal. And you may talk about, you may hear somebody being referred to as a god. You know, well, obviously most people don't believe that there's some sort of a divine attribute there. They're just saying this man is very skilled or very accomplished. So it should not seem strange to us that we would talk about giants being on the earth, and that talking about people who exercise great authority. All right. What about? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But in those cases, you know, we have explicit definition given to us. Well, this Og was so tall, and he had a large bed of iron, and Goliath was so tall, and Goliath's brother was so tall, that sort of thing. So, but we have those things given to us explicitly. But there's no reason to understand that these had to be a race of literal giants walking around. All right. Moving on, talking about God being grieved. So why was God grieved with mankind at this time? Yeah, because they were so wicked. So let's look at verse 6 here. Well, let's back up to verse 5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, that every intent, I mean, think about that, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. As you can imagine, that God being a good God, how else could he react to that? But then the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. This idea of sorry, you know, that you look at the word sorry and think, wow, did God somehow make a mistake? I don't think that's the idea there, but rather it's the idea that he sighed. If you look at the root of this word, it's the idea that he sighed. And so when do you sigh? You sigh when you're tired, or you sigh when you are grieved, when something makes you sad. You can just imagine God is looking down on this earth, and he's thinking, I'm going to have to destroy all of these people. But then, of course, we find one who finds favor in his sight, Noah. So tell me about Noah. One of the questions here was, how does Genesis describe Noah? So looking there in chapter 6, what are some of the descriptions that we get of Noah? I think we can even go on into chapter 7 and grab one as well. Okay? Yeah, exactly. I put up here a just man, but perfect or blameless in his time in verse 9 there. He walked with God in verse 9. Oh, by the way, sounds a lot like the way Enoch was described, right? The very same phrase. So a just man, perfect in his generations, walked with God. Up in verse 8, he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. What about in his execution of the instructions that God gave him regarding the ark there at the very end of the chapter? What does it say about how he responded to God's command? Yeah, did according to all that God commanded him. So whereas you have his contemporaries who thought on evil continually, Noah thought on pleasing God continually and did all that he commanded. And then finally we move into verse 7, and this is not something that the narrator, although I would say that the narrator is the Holy Spirit, but we have directly from the mouth of God here, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. So we have God's own testimony to Noah's face. This is what I think about you. This is how I judge your behavior before me. Now, what about the New Testament? Somewhat like Enoch, we have more about Noah, for sure, but we have some things said about Noah in the New Testament that are not necessarily obvious from the record here in Genesis. So what kind of things do you find in the New Testament? Preach of righteousness according to? Yeah, 2 Peter 2:5. And Peter really just, he doesn't even expound on that much. He just throws that in almost as an afterthought. If we could take a look at that right quick, 2 Peter 2:5, and of course, picking up in the middle of a thought here, what Peter is trying to say here, trying to get across to his audience, is that God does not overlook false teachers and what they're doing, and he will bring them to judgment. So he says in verse 5, he didn't spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. And so Peter's point, of course, is here we have Noah and his family, and out of a whole world of people, God was able to save them and yet judge, punish the rest of the entire world. And so he's trying to give comfort to, Peter is, trying to give comfort to his audience. Look, I know you guys are enduring some tough things. I know there are people who are acting wickedly. Don't think that God doesn't see those people and don't think that he won't bring them into judgment and at the same time save you. Certainly a lesson we get from the story of the flood. What's another mention that we have of Noah? Okay, right. And that's in Hebrews 11 verse 7 here. So look at what we have here. By faith, Noah being divinely warned of things not yet seen, and this of course plays right into the context of Hebrews 11. What's the point of Hebrews 11? We have men and women who behaved righteously. They trusted in God, even though they did not have all of the information, but they knew that they could trust what God said. And so here's Noah. Of course, there's an argument. I'll admit that I don't necessarily buy into it, but there's an argument that perhaps it had not rained. I think that when it says in Genesis that a mist rose up from the ground of water, I think that's basically telling us that it rained. But regardless, there's an argument that it hadn't even rained on the earth by this point. Well, Noah could see the raindrops the moment that God said, I'm going to bring a flood on this earth. Okay, so even if you argue that Noah had never seen rain before, still he believed that God was going to follow through and do what he was promising. And so moved with that godly fear because he trusted in the words of God, he went on and built the ark according to the plans that God gave him. And incidentally, let me throw one more thing in there that it may not have occurred to you to note, but we have some comment. If you'll turn over to Matthew chapter 24, we have some comment on Noah's contemporaries. Again, you might infer this, but it's kind of nice to have it explicitly stated. If we go over to Matthew 24 and verse 37, and this of course is in the I'll get there in a moment. This, of course, is in the midst of Jesus talking about his coming. In verse 27, he says, I'm sorry, no, not verse 27, verse 37. He says, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. And so the picture that Jesus paints there is that not only did the people not believe Noah's warnings, if Peter paints him as a preacher of righteousness, you get the impression that he was trying to tell his neighbors, his friends and neighbors, look, this is coming, folks. Not only did they not heed his warning, they just went on with business as usual. Can you imagine the mocking that he would have endured? Here's this guy building a boat, and you got to be kidding me. This has never happened before. But then they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that God shut Noah up in the ark, and then the rain starts to fall, and now they realize, oh, it is too late. So there's a palpable picture of fear there that we get in what Jesus has to say to us, and which I think we need to let sink in as we think about the flood and how those events unfolded. Trevor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Trevor says that Peter uses this to talk about how that this is coming suddenly and that the destruction is unlike anything before it. Of course, we'll get into that, the nature of this destruction in the flood versus the destruction that God promises in 2 Peter 3. Alrighty. So tell me about the ark itself. What information do we have about the ark, how it looked, how big it was, what it was made of, that sort of thing? Okay. And what is gopher wood? No idea. Yeah. We have no idea. Folks have some theories, but frankly, we just don't know. Nevertheless, it was something that God specified and Noah used it. What else? Okay, so he sealed it with pitch, okay? Okay, all right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, great, great big vessel. I will say that, you know, even my illustration here makes it look kind of like what we consider a boat to look like. The word ark just means something like box or chest. In other words, when we talk about the Ark of the Covenant, of course we have more information about what it looks like, but it was just a box, right? It wasn't a boat. It was just a box. Well, it may very well be, because this was not meant to be a vessel for traveling. It was simply meant to be a vessel for floating, right? So it may very well be that this didn't look much at all like any boat that we've ever seen. Nevertheless, we can't really say with certainty what the outside of the thing looked like. What about, there was a window, right? Where was the window? One cubit. Yep. One cubit from the top. How many doors did it have? One door. How many decks did it have? Three. Exactly. Now I took these, I didn't sit down and do the math myself. I trust the Waldrons and their calculations, but according to their calculations, if you take those three decks and the length and width that we have available to, if you take those three decks and add them all up, we're talking about 101,250 square feet of floor space. A total volume of 1,518,750 cubic feet total volume. So this is a great big thing. Of course, Sam gave a length here to help us judge it. Another way you can judge the length is a football field. If a cubit is roughly 18 inches, then this is about half again as long as a football field is. So this is a great big vessel. And then maybe I should ask two questions. Whom was Noah to take into the ark? And then what also was he to take into the ark? His family? Okay. Okay, all right. And then what was he supposed to take with him besides his family? Okay. Seven of every clean animal, male and female. I think the birds are mentioned as well. And then what about the unclean animals? Yeah, two. And of course, the way this reads, and it comes out when you look at different translations, I think I can pretty well say that when he says seven of every clean animal, a male and his female, we're talking about seven pairs. But then when you look at the two, it'll say two of every unclean animal, male and female. Are we talking about two pairs or are we talking about just two? It's a little hard to be definitive there, but regardless, Noah knew what God meant and he followed those instructions. All right, any comments about the ark in and of itself? I guess I should point out, God said, also bring with you all the food that you're going to need. Interesting, we know looking back about how long they were in the ark, but did Noah know how long they were going to be in the ark? I don't know. It doesn't really say. But apparently that was enough information for him to be able to bring enough food for them to survive on for the roughly year that they were in the ark. All right, any other comments on the ark or Noah's mission there? Yeah. And I don't know whether, again, Noah knew what he was talking about. So I don't know if we're talking, if the idea of clean and unclean animals has already been introduced, perhaps even by God himself, or if, I suppose it's possible that we're talking about something that there's a term for this called prolepsis, where we talk in terms that we understand today about things that had not necessarily been established at that point. In other words, God may have given Noah a list. Okay, I want you to take seven each of this, and this, and then two each of this, and this. Whereas Noah may not have known at that time that they were clean versus unclean animals.
And it's the law. Mm-hmm. Something's already in place.
Yes.
In animals.
Right.
By the time
he gets the garden, yes. 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 So as Stephen says there, we already have some history there as to what constitutes clean versus unclean animals, and so now God. Well, not now, but rather when we get to Exodus and God begins to codify that, it's based on some things that Moses has already begun to reveal to us, even in the record of Genesis. Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think that's important that people have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. They came to him in chapter 6, verse 20. Yeah, there's this, you know, when you're reading this and you're forming the picture in your mind, sometimes you have the idea that, well, God or Noah was having to run out and lasso these animals and bring them in, that sort of thing. And well, no, not really, apparently. But nevertheless, God does give him the commandment, seven of every clean animal and so on. So apparently there was something there, even though we can't be quite sure of just how much Noah did know. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes. Good point. When they leave the ark and Noah builds an altar and begins to sacrifice to God, he does not sacrifice to the unclean animals, but rather the clean animals. Good point. Right, exactly. Now, let me ask you this. How people want to say, now come on, you know, you look at all the varieties of animals that are out there. You're telling me that Noah was able to fit them all on this boat? I mean, it's big, but it's not that big. Come on. So what are some explanations for how Noah could have made this happen? Could have made this work? Yeah, I remember somebody making a point in a Bible class years ago along those lines. We have come along and we have said, well, this is a distinct species and this is a distinct species. Well, not necessarily. I mean, who's to say that those are necessarily different enough that they couldn't breed, or different enough that they are, at least insofar as Noah is concerned, they're different things, different animals. And so to say that he had to bring, I'll say at this point, two pairs. Let's say two pairs of unclean animals. And so he picks something that looks kind of like a dog and kind of like a wolf. All right. Well, we've got the bases covered. Or maybe it was some ancestor of our modern dogs and wolves that was basically common to both of them. That is really not outside the realm of the possibilities. I've heard somebody talk about how long it would take for so many varieties to appear. And they want to make the case, oh, we're talking thousands, millions of years. And it turns out, actually, in only hundreds of years, decades, really, we can have some pretty wide variety from just a single set of parents. Yes, sir?
Animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we have dogs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Different species.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So we say all this to say that he did not have to get every single variety of every type of animal. He had to get kinds represented. And oh, by the way, he didn't necessarily have to get the largest of that kind, or even the adults of that kind. He could have chosen to bring young versions. I feel like there's another word I'm searching for there. But anyway, he could have brought young dogs, young wolves, young horses, whatever he would happen to be bringing. He could have brought smaller, the smaller specimens. I think that's the word I was looking for. And not the larger specimens, and tried to maximize the how much would fit into the ark. Okay. So now that we've talked about everything leading up to the ark and they finally get onto the ark, give me a timeline sort of of how things took place. How old was Noah, for instance, when the rain began to fall, when he entered the ark and the rain began to fall? We're even given down to the month and the day.
600th year.
Mm-hmm. 600th year.
17th day of the month.
Yep, 600th year, second month, 17th day of the month. So we know the day that the rain started, all right? How do things go after that? Who, by the way, shuts the door? Yeah, God. God shuts the door. How long does it rain? I know you've known this since you were kids. 40 days, 40 nights. And then how long? I have to admit, it's not entirely clear. It's perhaps easy enough to go back and do the math, but I didn't do it. But, how long does it say the floodwaters remained on the earth? Well, I mean, specifically in 724, how long does it say that the floodwaters remained? Yeah, 150 days that it prevailed on the earth. So, okay, yes, I guess that is a slight distinction, prevailed versus remained. So is that 150 days after it stopped raining? Is that 100? Does that 150 days encompass the 40? I'm not absolutely certain, but the waters began to recede after that 150 days. And so we have the ark resting on Mount Ararat in month number 7. We have, it says that the mountains emerged in month number 10. And then after another 40 days, that's when we have Noah sending the raven and the dove out. The raven remains flying about out there. The dove comes back, though. And then over the course of another couple of weeks, he sends it out a couple more times. And finally, the dove does not come back anymore. And so then finally, when does Noah take the cover off of the ark and look out to see that the earth is dry? Well, okay. Well, actually, that's when it says that it was dry. But he removed the cover back in verse 13, 600 first year, first month, first day. And then they finally come out in the second month, in the 227th, second month and 27th day. Or rather, I should say the earth is dried, and then it says in 15 through 19 that they exit the ark. All right. Now that we have, the floodwaters are gone, what begins to happen? We've talked a bit about, I think I've gotten ahead of myself here, floodwaters come, recede, and now let's talk about God's promise. So God makes a promise after the floodwaters recede. And what is that promise, in short? Right, exactly. And as we go into chapter 9, he explains, I'm not going to do this with water ever again. Now, as Trevor mentioned already, we have a destruction that Peter does promise, and it's going to be by fire. I mean, I'll tell you all, I can distinctly remember my great-grandmother talking to me about this and saying, well, God's never going to destroy the earth with water again, but he is going to do it with fire. And that's certainly what we see there. A promise here, the sign of the rainbow that shows that this promise continues to this day. And what are some other changes that took place after, I shouldn't say change, what are some changes that took place in particular with regard to diet after the flood?
The 42, I think, mm-hmm. Important part of the promise.
Okay.
While the earth
ceases. Mm-hmm.
So there's provided.
Mm-hmm.
So
good point.
That's a
foundation. Yeah, good point, good point. All right then, so we have changes in diet. What were we allowed to eat before the flood? What did God give as food to mankind before the flood? Yeah, and we go back to Genesis 2, the plants of the field, of every tree you can eat, but then of course the one. But then what do we see him after the flood granting to man to be able to eat? Yeah, any living thing. And furthermore, he goes on to talk about, let's see, is this where I want to be? Yeah. He goes on to talk about the shedding of blood. Number one, you can eat the flesh, but don't eat the blood that is in the flesh. That is a life. And so we have to drain that blood. And that's something that he not only repeats in the Law of Moses and Leviticus, but also, if you recall, in Acts, the letter that they send to the Gentiles, abstain from blood. So that apparently is an expectation that God still has for us. We don't need to be going over to the UK and enjoying some blood pudding for that very reason. But also, what distinction does he draw between animals that we can kill and eat for food versus mankind? Exactly, exactly. And why does he say that if you shed a man's blood, your blood will be shed? What is distinct about man versus animals? Made in the image of God. Okay, so there's this idea that we're just another animal. No, we are not just another animal. And there's this idea that if you decide to abort a baby, it's just a bunch of cells. No. Because we are made in the image of God, we have inherent worth. And that is so important to keep in mind when we get into these arguments with folks about things like that. It's perfectly, not that you have to eat animals, but it's perfectly fine to. You're not taking a soul by killing an animal to eat it. But you are certainly taking a soul when you put a child or a man to death for the sake of convenience or any other reason. Now, I would say that since he says, if you shed blood, a man will shed your blood, that gives us divine approval for capital punishment, for the offense of murder. Now, we might have a discussion as to whether it's carried out justly, but do we have God's approval for it? Yes, I think we do, and we can rest on that. All right, so, of course I didn't get far enough. I'll just let Chris know to say a word about the Tower of Babel and then pick up with Terah and his sons on Sunday. Thank you all for your attention and your comments.